Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage orthopedic surgeon John Lapkus. Joint replacement surgery is certainly becoming more common, with knees and hips being replaced most often. As of about 2009, almost 750,000 of Americans have had hips or knees replaced each year in the United States. If you've got questions or comments about our discussion today about various joint replacements, their indications, risks, and expected outcomes, please feel free to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Lapkus has been in Alaska for a number of years, for about 16 years. He was the Anchorage neighbor at the Native Medical Center, and then for the last 6 years has moved over to the Anchorage Fracture and Orthopedic Clinic. John, it's a real pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I always struggle a little bit about where to start, but there was something in what I was reading that seemed like a reasonable place, and that's to talk about the distinction between maybe two options for people who are having joint problems. That's joint replacement and joint preservation. How do we define those? What do we mean by that?
Joint preservation is, as the name implies, attempts made to preserve the patient's own joint, his own biology, whereas joint replacement is when you basically throw in the towel and say there's nothing else we can do other than put in a new joint, replace the one that you've got that's not serving you anymore.
What are some of the options for joint preservation, then, that so people could understand what options are available in that?
You've got your non-surgical options, non-steroidal medications or Tylenol, activity modification, weight loss, modalities such as injections, viscosupplementation, supplementation, or cortisone injections, physical therapy. Sometimes then you get into the realm of less invasive procedures, relatively less invasive, arthroscopy for joint cleanups, other soft tissue procedures to possibly stabilize a joint and preserve its life.
Okay. And since they've become so much more common, it raises the issue that the technology, the equipment, the training, all of that must be better, and we must also be aware that the long-term outcomes of these kinds of surgeries have improved over time. Are those the important critical variables that have allowed this to happen much more commonly?
Yes, that's correct. The whole technique of joint replacement has evolved over the past decades to be one that is overall amazingly and uniformly successful, very highly reproducible. And added to that is the life-changing outcome of these replacements when they're successful. You combine a very high probability of success with fairly dramatic results, and it is a very popular operation.
What are the joints that are, we mentioned hips and knees as being the most common. I assume that's correct. And if it's not, please correct me. And then what other joints are you doing or that might be done in Alaska? And then if you don't mind, if there's joints that are not done in Alaska, what are the reasons for that?
Hips and knees are certainly the most common, with knees nationwide being the most common, followed by hips. And those are, the two of those together is by far outnumbers any other joints. The next, in terms of commonality, is a shoulder replacement. That's on the order of 20 to 30,000 a year, just a fraction of the percentage of hips and knees. And other joints that can be replaced include elbow joints, ankles, fingers, toes. And this is not purely my realm, of course, but even discs at this point, and that sort of counts as a joint replacement, but that's not what this discussion is about.
Sure. And What are the most common reasons that lead people to have this? You brought up in the conversation before we came up not juvenile, but rheumatoid arthritis, which surprised me. I was going to guess that trauma was a big issue. But if you wouldn't mind mentioning, maybe with each joint, the most common reasons that bring people to this decision.
Overall, the most common is osteoarthritis or just
wear and tear.
Yeah. You know, just get older and your parts wear out. That overall is the most common. Inflammatory arthritis is probably the second most common, and that's an autoimmune disease where your body basically attacks its own cartilage and destroys the joints. And probably next beyond that is traumatic arthritis, which is, as the name implies, a situation where a joint has been severely traumatized, fractures within the joint or some other mechanism where it's wrecked.
Okay. We do have a caller already, maybe another one coming in. I'm going to go ahead and take the first caller since he got on the phone very quickly. Dale, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, I'm a 67-year-old male, very active, as a youth and an adult. My right knee pretty much shot. I was approved for a replacement about a year and a half ago at the VA. And then just when I was scheduling the surgery, they said, "Have you ever had a shot?" And I, it's a cortisone shot. I said, "No." So they gave me one, and I've had two now in the last year and a half. And they seem to last about 8 months or so. But I remember when I was young in athletics, everybody was saying, don't get the cortisone shots because it'll deteriorate the joints. Is that a danger at this point in my life?
You're absolutely right. That cortisone used injudiciously can definitely damage a joint. Cortisone is a two-edged sword, and it's a very dose-related effect. Cortisone, on the one hand, is an anti-inflammatory. It calms an upset, inflamed joint, which is how you get its benefit. But cortisone also weakens collagen, which is the basic building block of cartilage, tendons, and all the joint capsule and everything, ligaments in and around the joint. And if you get too much of that, you do start to actually get breakdown of cartilage, breakdown of ligaments, joint capsule, and so forth. And that's in particular a concern if you're a 20-year-old athlete. Now, if you're, 67 and headed for a total joint anyway, that effect is really of little concern. And the general dosing that we prescribe is that you don't want to have more than about 3 cortisone injections per year. So that's an average of 1 every 4 months in any one location. If you stay below that, you probably won't get much in all those undesirable effects.
Well, that's good. That's good news. And I try not to put anything in my body that I don't need. So I think I will try and hold down the number of shots because I still don't trust the replacements. How long they last. In other words, I don't want to go through this 2 or 3 times if I happen to live to be 90. Right. If I'm going to have it replaced, I want to make sure that they're good for 20 or 30 years, and then I'll do it.
Well, Dale, why don't we, if you don't mind, hang on just a second, and let's follow you along. I don't think this is probably that unusual of a situation. So what I'm hearing is that those steroids used occasionally may postpone the need for some period of time for the use of a knee replacement, for example, in Dale's place. So again, it's individualized, depends on the age of the person and the problems they're having. And if you want to say anything about what I just said, John, go ahead and say something. But then the next question he's waiting on is, what about the longevity of the knee replacement? Since we'll address that issue since he brought it up as well.
That's a great question, and that's the question everybody has, is how long is this thing going to last? Analogy I like to use is an analogy of, say, going to the car store. You go to the car dealership, you buy a new car, And you ask the salesman, well, how long is this thing going to last? And he kind of shrugs his shoulders and says, well, it depends. You know, you go home, you park the thing in your garage, and you go to the grocery store once a week, the thing is going to last you, you know, forever. But you take that car out to Palmer, and you get on the oval, and you floor it, and you just go around and around and around, and you'll probably blow it up in a couple of days. And, you know, the joint is a mechanical part, and it's going to wear if used sort of just judiciously for daily activities, and you don't become a marathoner or something like that, you can rightfully expect 15 to 20 years and even longer, just with average use.
And this is just with knees.
And snowshoeing and mm-hmm. climbing days are over. So I think so if they last that long, that's good news to me, because I'll go for a couple more years with maybe one shot or two shots a year, and then I'll go ahead and get the replacement. Mm-hmm.
Is there a rate limiting time? I mean, the other thing is he said, I think Dale said he was around 68. Is there a time when it becomes less feasible or ethical? I mean, I'll even throw that word in to be doing the joint replacements.
In other words, are you too old?
Yeah. Is there a time when that really? And I know you have to individualize.
Right. And I would say no. Anybody whose quality of life is affected to that degree, to where they're considering a joint replacement, I think is a candidate.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you so much for the information. As usual, this show is just a great source of solid medical information. Thank you.
So we're trying to do, Dale. Thanks very much for your call.
You bet. Bye.
Andy, you're on line one.
Hey, I have had a hip at 48 years old. I think I inherited some bad genes from my grandmother. And kind of referring back to Dale, you know, he's a little concerned about the longevity. I was pretty much crippled at 48. Had that total hip and got a life back. I could walk. I could run around, chase my kid, snowshoe, skied. And 11 years later, the other one went. So I've had two. And it's a miracle. The modern surgical miracle. And if you've got doubts, I think Dale said he was 68. Go tomorrow, Dale. You just can move and you can do things you haven't been able to do in a long time. I don't know what else to say. Okay. You know, it's quite the thing.
Yeah, I think it at least the statistics suggest that people are pretty happy with the results.
Well, I'm 13 years on the first one and 3 or 4 on the second one, and I have a tiny little hitch in my giddy-up, but I don't run anymore. Thank goodness it got me out. Yeah. Gave me an excuse not to do that anymore. I did it all through high school and college. So, but climb hills, run around, chase dogs. You're good to go.
Your points are great, and they're hugely valuable. That's a giant consideration in doing a replacement, especially in a younger person. It's a quality of life. I mean, you said you're 48. You can't chase your kids. You can't walk your dog, all these things. And we never know what's going to happen tomorrow. So that's, if you are that impacted at a young age, that's where people start thinking of having a joint replacement so they can get their life back, because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Well, when I had the last consult with the surgeon before doing this, he said, you know, how far can you actually walk? And, you know, a mile or 2 miles. I couldn't walk down to the end of the driveway to get the newspaper. And that was 100 feet. And so, you know, crutches were the next option. And I always remember my grandmother, who I blame all this genetic arthritis on. But she lived to the ripe old age of 93. And, you know, that might be a fair trade. I'll trade a couple of hips for 93. So, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Andy.
Sure, you bet.
Well, while we're on that kind of topic about what are the symptoms that should be driving people to make this decision? Obviously, you lose enough mobility, and then it becomes a problem. Is there a time before you get to that there's enough symptoms that should alert people that they ought to be considering this? How do you go about telling people what symptoms? How do you know you're ready, so to speak?
I think it just purely comes down to pain. I think people can live with stiffness if it's not too painful. You know, most everything else you can live with, but it's when you have chronic pain, and then especially when you start having not just pain with activity, but then when you have pain at rest, and then you have pain at night, and you can't sleep, and you know, you sit and watch a movie, and then to get up, you have to, you know, somehow brace yourself with both your hands to stand up, and then just seriously limp for a while to get out of the theater, and so forth. It comes down to pain.
Are there times, you mentioned that age may not be a contraindication, but are there other problems? May the bone, for whatever reason, that you need to work with not sufficient, not good enough? Are there other things that may prevent the use of joint replacement?
About the primary contraindication is a history of infection or sepsis. If you have a history of having had an infection in the joint, that's something that's taken very seriously. That's something that can crop up, you know, after the replacement and can really be a major issue. But as far as strictly as far as bone quality, we can almost always implant a joint. I mean, it may not be as simple and straightforward as in a 50-year-old or something like that, but the implants, there are multiple augments and specialized implants and devices that can accommodate, you know, virtually anybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if someone is having significant joint pain and discomfort and disability, it seems to me that you're saying it makes sense to at least discuss the option, the pros and cons, the side effects, the recovery and so forth with an experienced orthopedic surgeon, at least to know what your options are better.
Sure, absolutely.
What about the recovery time from knees versus hips? I've heard that the knee is a much more difficult one, but maybe that was 4 or 5 years ago, and yet more people that I see more recently, I haven't heard as much about that. Is the recovery different, and have we improved our ability to rehabilitate after these replacements?
Well, in general, I would agree with you. Knees tend to be more difficult than hips to rehabilitate, but it's a whole different joint, not just in terms of its location, but in terms of its function and its mechanics. A knee is basically a hinge joint. It has relatively little soft tissue coverage. A hip is a ball and socket with some big fat muscles totally in enclosing the joint. A hip is significantly easier to rehabilitate, maybe in part because of just all the muscles and soft tissue coverage and the fact that it's so multidirectional. People tend to have less pain with a total hip. With a hip replacement, they tend to move it around with much less pain postoperatively than a knee, which again is just purely a hinge joint that has fairly minimal soft tissue coverage. It just goes in one direction, and you know, for whatever reason, knees tend to be more painful and take a bit longer to rehab than a hip does.
Okay, we have another caller. I'm going to take Peter. Peter, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I have a question for Dr. Lapkus. I was wondering, or discuss the merits of having a total hip replacement versus arthroscopic surgery to treat a hip labral tear. I'm a 55-year-old who doesn't have serious osteoarthritis. And the reason I'm asking is that, you know, I had this decision last year, and I chose the arthroscopic surgery. And now my insurance company is denying the claim because I was older than 54 years. And I was, which indicated that I should have had a total hip replacement instead. I'm just trying to sort of understand, like, some of the rationale.
Yeah. Holy moly. Sit me down, tie me down on that one, man. Replacing a hip for a labral tear is like hitting a finishing nail with a sledgehammer. It, That's the first I'd heard about an age issue, this cutoff of 54. I've not come across that before. I've done hip arthroscopy in as old as an 80-year-old before. But
yeah, like I said, it seems it seems outlandish, or it seems odd to me. I guess I'm sort of in agreement. You're curious, what might be their thinking, or what would be a good argument to counter back to them with.
Well, geez, where do you start? If you truly have no significant arthritic changes in your hip, and you are having hip pain from a labral tear, and labral tears are painful, that falls into that category of joint preservation. And in general, if you can preserve a joint, it's better than any replacement we can do. I mean, if your own joint works, it's going to work better than any replacement. And if you don't have, again, if you don't have any coexisting osteoarthritis, a labral tear can be repaired. It can heal, and you can potentially get back to normal function, which is something that, a hip replacement won't quite let you do in terms of like running and impact activities and so forth. If you just repair your labrum, you've got your own joint, and you can go on with essentially normal activities and normal life.
Okay. No. Well, good. Well, thanks for saying that. And like I said, I did have a labral pair, the labral surgery.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, Peter, I don't want to butt in here too much, but I mean, it sounds like if you haven't appealed that needs to be repealed so that you can find out and ask them their rationale, so you could argue back. I mean, it really sounds a little odd to me as well.
Yeah. Okay. No. I think so. I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
All righty. Well, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck. So we've talked a lot about hips and knees. Another question that comes to my mind is sometimes people ask about whether they should have both knees done at one time or not. Any thoughts or guidelines or comments about that kind of question?
That's something that comes up not infrequently. And a lot of individuals will have arthritis involving both knees, or both hips for that matter, but it's exceedingly rare to do bilateral hip replacements, almost to the point where that's not even discussed. I mean, it's mm-hmm. so rare. I have done that before, but the indications in the situation is probably one in a million. But in knees, it's a much more common issue. For several reasons, the surgery involved, the length of surgery is relatively speaking not that long, an hour to an hour and a half per knee, so you can do both knees, without taking all day. Knee surgeries are generally done with a tourniquet, so the blood loss overall is, at least during surgery, is fairly minimal. The biggest issue to consider when thinking about doing bilateral replacements is the rehab afterwards. The first week or two is hell. So the discussion you have to have with the patient is that, if you understand that you're just going to be hating life for a week or two after doing both of your knees, then if you can accept that, and then it's something you can consider. Probably 90% of the time or more, we do just one knee at a time and stage them. And for most individuals, that's, leaves them one good leg to stand on. It's literally, and they can rehab one knee. And then when life is back in order, they can come back and get the other knee done if they do have arthritis in both knees. But in some instances, if the deformities are significant. Somebody has either flexion contractures, they just can't get either leg out straight. That's probably the single prime indication for doing both knees at the same time, because if you replace one knee and on the OR table, you're get it to where the patient can put his leg out straight, and then they go to rehab and stand up and walk. They have to walk crouched over because the other knee doesn't go straight. So it can lead to developing a flexion contracture in the just replaced knee. So, and the same applies to angle deformities too, what we call varus or valgus knees. If you have severely bowed knees or severe knock knees, it can sometimes be good to get both of your legs straightened out so it doesn't look like you're somehow standing in a strong crosswind or something. There are medical concerns to doing both knees. You know, it's certainly a bigger stress on your system to do both of your knees. So in general, you need to be healthy enough to be able to take that. Paradoxically, there's one relative indication for doing both knees at once, and that is just an individual who is just so sick that even doing one anesthetic and one knee, the anesthetic is the big risk. So sometimes in those cases, you will actually say, well, we're going to put you to sleep once, and while you're asleep, we'll get both knees done, and just so we don't have to put you to sleep twice.
What is it that makes that period of time after both replacements hell, as you said? Is it pain? Is it inability to move around, a combination of that and something else?
Or? Yeah, the combination of the pain primarily. It hurts after a knee replacement for sure. And even though you are allowed to bear full weight, the joint will take full weight from the get-go. It's not comfortable to put full weight on it. And if you have had just one knee done, you can get by with just partial weight bearing until you are comfortable putting full weight on there, which is usually 2, 3, 4 weeks. But if you've had both knees done, you've got no choice. If you're going to walk, you have to put full weight. And, you know, you'll do it with the support of crutches or walker, but nonetheless, it's full weight. So it makes getting around initially difficult. And then again, the pain issues.
Let me, I think what we're going to do is take our break today. I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We're in Anchorage, and our number is 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to take any calls and emails as we discuss joint replacement surgery with Anchorage orthopedic surgeon Dr. John Lapkus. You're listening to Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. John Lapkus. He's an Anchorage orthopedic surgeon, and we're talking about joint replacement surgery. We spent a lot of time talking about hips and knees, and we may virtually move into some other joints, a little bit dependent on the phone calls and the emails. And you can do each of those things. Our local number is 550-8433. That's the number to call if you've got questions or comments that you'd like us to address. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the usual warning, if you're listening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast. You'll have to call back in, or we won't be able to answer your question unless you call during this next 30 minutes or so. I would remind people that you can always go to alaskapublic.org/line1 and find podcasts that have been done in the past, and they're easy to look at. You can also go to iTunes and the store and find those broadcasts on the podcast there as well. Let me also just take just a brief second before we get back to Dr. Lapkus to mention that the annual prostate cancer screening is continuing to ongo. Last week it was Alaska Regional. This week it's at Providence Hospital, September 26th through 29th in the evenings, 5:30 to 8:30. If you want to find out more for the Providence screening, the number is 212-6872. Our Valley will have a screening out at the hospital in the Valley on September 30th. That number you'd have to call. No, it's 745-9300 for the Valley screening clinic. We have a couple of callers. Let's go ahead and take one. We have a number all of a sudden, so let's see what we can do with those. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I've had both a shoulder and a knee replaced, and now my phone is beeping, so I'll be quick. the frustration with the knee was not the pain. I'd had a lot of pain, so that was just more of the same. Be more honest about how long it takes to get back to what you might consider normal. Everyone said I was a quick study and I was healing very quick. It was a full 2 years before I could go hunch down on my haunches, uh-huh. And where I felt like I was back.
And what was what's your age and what was the underlying problem that you had?
I was 62. The underlying problem was arthritis. The surgeon said that it was remarkable. it was a lot of pain, and it was in so much pain that I've decided I don't need to have the second one done, because once I got rid of the pain in the first one, the second one's doing just fine.
Good.
The shoulder, the problem was that they used a block, which was great, but I can't take morphine. And when I went off that block, that was the worst pain I've ever had in my life.
Okay. So she's asking, you're asking basically, does it take everybody 2 years to get back to normal?
Probably not, but I was kept being told that I was really doing well. I mean, okay. I was walking with a cane within a month.
Okay.
And I was doing well. Within 6 months, I went snowshoeing. So it was functional. It was very functional. But it took me that long to feel that I had really did it. You know, now I don't even think about that knee anymore.
I tend to tell patients figure 6 months to a year for a knee. 6 months to a year. And, you know, there's nothing written in stone about that. Some folks certainly can take longer until you plateau to the max. Shoulders, I tell people, 2 years. You know, shoulders are even more difficult than knees to rehabilitate, and you really need to allow about 2 years or so to fully plateau from a shoulder replacement.
All righty. Let's take another caller. Pauline, you're on line one.
Hi. I had my knee replaced it'll be 4 years this November, and I am not happy with it because I've been in pain ever since. I've gone back to my surgeon, and I went through two rounds of extensive physical therapy trying to stretch the scar tissue, but I'm still dealing with pain every day, and now I'm suffering from my kidneys because I take so much ibuprofen, and I just don't know what to do about it because the therapy will give a little bit of result. But my question is, could a bone be allergic, or could I have, why the pain? Why? I try to exercise. I've done everything my doctor has said, but, you know, the pain that I have with the replacement is almost as bad as the arthritis. So I was just thinking, what's my next step? I don't know whether to go back to my surgeon or go back to therapy, but after almost 4 years, I thought I'd, you know.
Yeah, you ought to be better.
I ought to be out of pain, at least.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one of the hardest problems or hardest issues we deal with in relation to joint replacements is the one that's painful after your procedure. I mean, these are 95 to 97% successful, but they are not 100% successful. And if you're in that 3 to 5% that's still having issues, it doesn't matter that the other 95 are working. And the reasons for pain after a replacement are, there are multiple factors. They may be local factors having to do with the prosthesis itself. And one of the things you alluded to is there is a certain percentage of the population that's metal sensitive or even metal allergic. And there are tests that can be done to evaluate for that. And that is a potential reason. It's not the most common reason, but it is a potential reason for continued pain and stiffness and so forth.
All right. So should I call my physician?
Hey,
every time I've gone in for x-rays, he says the joint's working normally and everything's fine.
Yeah. Hold on just a second, Paul. And let's continue with other reasons why we may have the pain, and then I think, you know, I think the logical answer is not, it wouldn't hurt to get another opinion perhaps, but let's see what Dr. Lapkus has to say.
Okay.
Yeah, there are other reasons in from the joint itself are lack of solid fixation. I don't know if your joint was cemented or press fit. In other words, if press fit, I mean no cement used. In uncemented joints, if there is not good fixation, you can have chronic pain. If the thing is just loose, basically, there is a possibility, although at 4 years, well, I'll just throw out these things. An ongoing low-grade infection can produce ongoing pain. You may consider doing an aspiration of the joint to see if there's any, or have your surgeon do an aspiration of the joint to see if there's any evidence of any sort of process like an infection going on. You have more potential whole body thing. I don't know if you have anything like fibromyalgia or any sort of other more systemic.
No,
do any of your other joints hurt?
It's just the knee.
Just the knee.
It's progressively, I've noticed it's getting worse. I was, mm-hmm. after a couple of years, I was able to walk, but I just went on a 5-mile walk, and I could barely make it back to my truck, and that concerns me because it looks like I'm getting worse instead of better.
That's concerning. That's even more concerning when it gets progressively more painful. And there are tests and studies that can be done to evaluate for infection and for loosening. And those would be the first two guesses or things that need to be evaluated and ruled in or ruled out.
So that means go back to the doctor.
Correct.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for your call, Pauline. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce, you're on line one?
Yes, hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'm a 70-year-old, and I'm in pretty good shape, do a lot of aerobic exercise at the fitness center, but I've had difficulty with, I think it's called PTTD, post-tibial tendon dysfunction. And it's where it's caused my arch, my left foot, to fall, and therefore my ankle tends to pronate inward, and it's gotten progressively worse over the last 10 years or so. I've gotten orthotics. I've gotten an ankle brace that has an inflatable bladder under the arch, which has helped a lot, but it isn't getting any better, and it's affecting my gait and my fitness routine and so forth. So I was wondering if there is a surgery for that, and I've heard where there is. I've done a little internet research, but it sounds awful, to tell you the truth.
That's getting a little bit out of the realm of joint replacement there. The PTTB is a posterior tibialis. That's one of the tendons that goes down around the ankle. When that fails, and potentially in your case, sounds like it may have even ruptured since you're kind of going over into a flat foot.
Yeah, that's possible. I think that's the diagnosis I've had. But I guess what I was asking was, have I heard of such things as ankle replacement? Is that not the issue in this case? Or
no, you would not do an ankle replacement for this. One of the necessary factors preoperatively for an ankle replacement is that you have to have fairly normal ankle anatomy and strength.
I see.
So you would almost automatically not be a candidate for ankle replacement with this.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to waste your time here.
No. I actually took your call because I wanted to get into the ankle replacement issue, Bruce. Okay. I wish we could help you a little bit more, but it sounds like there might be some surgical alternatives, but the replacement might not be the right one here.
Correct. Okay, thank you very much.
You bet, Bruce.
Bye.
Let's talk briefly about ankle replacement. We talked about it beforehand, and I said, you know, gosh, I don't see that happening very much. Why not?
Well, the bottom line is that an ankle replacement is a small device. It's it's bigger than a postage stamp, but certainly smaller than an iPhone. I mean, it's a small device, and the stresses that cross an ankle joint are tremendous, especially when looked at per unit area. I mean, you've got your entire body weight going across this little, you know, 1.5 inch by 1.5 inch little thing. And they fail. I mean, maybe not quite universally fail, but they fail at a very high rate because of the loads that are, they just can't take it. And it's not their fault. They're just asking too much of a little prosthesis. People have been trying to develop an ankle replacement that can somehow take all that weight, or take all that stress. But to date, nothing stands up to the test of time. I mean, they work well for a few years, but then they wear out. And the problem when an ankle replacement wears out is that you have to resect a certain amount of bone to make room for the implant. And when the implant fails, the salvage operation is an ankle arthrodesis or an ankle fusion. And your bone has been shortened by anywhere from 0.5 inch to 1 inch to allow placement of the prosthesis. So you have to get bone ends together to do a fusion. And as it implies, that leaves you with a short leg. So to my knowledge, there's nobody in Alaska doing ankle replacements. And there are very few. There are some around the country. You can look. There are some around the country. But if you're considering something like that, you really need to think carefully about what you're trying to gain and what you're willing to, what kind of risk you're willing to take, and what you're going to do when the thing fails.
All right. So, like many situations, there may be a few individual situations where it might make more sense. But for the vast majority of people, well, the technology is not there yet.
Absolutely, especially for the relatively young and active person. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're older individual and fairly sedentary, that may be somebody you may consider. But an older, or relatively speaking, younger person who wants to be active, who wants to have their ankle replaced so they can go back to, you know, running around and doing all the hiking and all the things they used to do, would be, I think, misguided.
Okay. Thanks very much for that. Pat, you're on line one.
Oh, hello, doctor. About 3 months ago, I started having symptoms in my left hip, which have progressively become more noticeable. And I can make my regular stride, and I do quite a bit of walking. But at times, for instance, I can't lay on it at night. And then in certain positions, it's a fair amount of pain will come to me, and also in certain positions, it wants to just feel as if it's not going to support my weight anymore, my left hip area. And I guess I'm asking, I'm not sure how I would enter the system. Should I go to my primary, I am on Medicare, go to my primary care doctor and then have him x-ray it and start like that, or can I go directly to some specialist with this symptom getting a diagnosis in that way? And do you happen to have a diagnosis, opinions about it?
Well, I don't have a diagnosis. I mean, you have to start with an exam and certainly an x-ray. Whether you can, I'm happy to see folks as a specialist, you know, directly on something like this, but it may be easier for you to have your primary provider at least obtain an x-ray first to see, with either avenue, either whether it be at an orthopedic specialty clinic like mine or whether it be with your primary provider, somebody's going to have to get an x-ray to start with. I mean, that's step one, is to get an x-ray.
And the x-ray that he would give me would be on par with one that I would get at the specialist. I mean, there's not like different equipment or different expertise in taking the x-ray or anything. So whatever he did at his office would be good enough then, huh?
Correct. And a lot of primary medical providers don't even have x-ray machines in their office. I mean, they will refer you over to
Okay, I could go through him then, I guess, and then approach a specialist from there, I guess.
That's probably the more common way to approach it, is to visit your primary provider first and get an exam, an x-ray, an opinion, and then have them just refer on.
Uh-huh. Should you think if I, of course, this is my own thinking, I guess, but should I act on immediately or wait till the problem gets worse to the point that then it's like, well,
don't wait. Yeah. If it's getting worse, take the pediatric advice.
I would agree with that. If you're thinking about it that much enough to make a phone call, then you probably need to have it checked. I mean, there are some little zebras out there that you don't want to sit on for any longer than you have to.
The thought of bone cancer comes to my mind too, but I should get an expert on opinion instead of just starting. All right. Well, thank you, guys.
All right. Good luck.
Bye.
Joan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi there. I'm very active and strong and, you know, a pretty go-go person, but I'm having some pain on the outside of my hip joint. It's like it feels bruised. Sometimes really feels bruised, but it's not actually in the joint, and I'm not crippled or it's not ruining my gait or anything like it, but the bruising, I don't know, it feels bruised, but it's not discolored or anything.
If it's right on the side of your hip, right where you feel that point of bone?
Yeah.
Yeah, the most common thing that causes pain there is what we call trochanteric bursitis. That lump, that point of bone you feel is called the greater trochanter. That's the upper end of your femur. And there's a bursa that directly overlies the greater trochanter there. That's a separation between the trochanter and the overlying soft tissues. And that bursa can get inflamed. It's called trochanteric bursitis, and it's a very common place to develop a bursitis, right on the lateral side of your hip there, right where you feel that point.
Right.
And you can try certain types of, I don't know if I'll go into the detail of the types, but there are physical therapy type stretches that can be done that can be helpful with that. You can take some anti-inflammatory medication like ibuprofen or Aleve, you know, any of those things.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Ice or heat over the area, creams like any sort of aspirin cream, or there's some other prescription type creams that we have that can transdermally put some medication in, and then a cortisone injection, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about this salve from Germany called Tramiel?
Not specifically. There are a number of creams like that seem that have a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication in it that is sort of commonly used in creams called Diflucan, and a lot of European preparations have that in there. I can't say for sure, however. I'm not familiar with this one specifically.
Okay, well, thanks. That clarified something. Thank you very much.
Okay, well,
you're welcome.
Yep.
Bye.
All right, let's go ahead and take, we have one more caller, and then I've got some issues. I want to talk about complications of some of this surgery and some of the maybe not so common causes for some hip problems. Gene, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I recently have seen on Google advertisement for a laser surgery for spine arthritis and stenosis. Is anybody in town doing those things?
For spine?
Yeah. Laser surgery for spine.
Not that I'm aware of, but you know, that is, again, this we're talking about joint replacements now, and I don't know. I don't do spine work myself.
Yeah, John, you're talking about spinal stenosis. Is that right?
Yeah, that's extensive advertisement that in the Institute for Spine mm-hmm. for laser surgery. Yeah. As describing all those things, and you can send MRI report or CTs to
them. Dr. Lapkus, and I don't know the answer to your question about whether it's being done. There is a couple of groups of neurosurgeons that I would refer you to their office to ask that question and to see if it's being done here locally.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. Sorry we couldn't help you any better than that. Dr. Lapkus, what is avascular necrosis and what is hip dysplasia and how does that relate to hip problems in particular?
Avascular necrosis is dead bone in the femoral head, in the ball. It affects other bone locations as well, but specifically in relation to the hip, it's basically dead bone. The bone is a living tissue. It requires a blood supply just like your heart or anything else does. And the blood supply to the ball comes up through the neck of the femur, and the blood supply can be disrupted by several different mechanisms. But the end result is that a segment or sometimes the entire head dies. The blood supply is cut off, it dies. Just like you have a heart attack, you get ischemic muscle in the heart, and that section of myocardium dies. So with avascular necrosis, a portion of the ball or all the ball dies. The bone becomes chalky and brittle, and the overlying cartilage collapses. It doesn't have the underlying support of the normal healthy bone. And it progressively, the end stage, the natural history is one of just progressive collapse of the head. It turns to chalk and the whole thing just collapses like an old building. Dysplasia is generally a congenital situation where, just in a nutshell, the hip isn't formed right. Either the covering, the socket is very shallow and the ball does not sit in the socket adequately. The angle of the head and neck is such that the stresses are applied in a non-physiologic manner across the joint. And there are other situations, but the bottom line is that the anatomy of the hip is not right from the beginning. And the stresses across the joint are not normal. And the stresses are such that the articular cartilage fails over time. The stresses applied lead it to eventually come apart and you develop arthritis. So both of those, avascular necrosis and dysplasia, both lead to early degeneration and damage to the articular cartilage of the joint.
So these are often the cause in young adults who may not have osteoarthritis, that wear and tear, or they don't have rheumatoid or inflammatory arthritis and no obvious trauma. Those are things that come to mind that may have happened to them.
Correct. Yep.
Why does avascular necrosis, give us a couple of the more common reasons why that may happen. I mean, that seems like a terrible thing to happen. And I know in pediatrics, we think about both of these issues. So I wanted to see if you'd comment on those.
Probably the single most common thing that leads to avascular necrosis is steroids. That's not taking one cortisone injection but long-term steroids, high-dose steroids, for multiple reasons, medical issues or otherwise, but basically steroids. Alcohol, again, not having a glass of wine with dinner, but mm-hmm. heavy drinking over an extended period of time leads to avascular necrosis. Bends, if you happen to be a deep sea diver, folks end up with avascular necrosis. Sickle cell anemia tends to produce that or can produce that.
Okay.
And then we just have an idiopathic where sometimes you just don't know.
Okay. Since I do a lot of asthma and allergy work, and the word steroids still carry a bad connotation to a large group of people, I'm going to ask if you would agree with the statement that when we're talking about steroids causing this avascular necrosis of the hip, we're talking about injectable or oral steroids, not the inhaled kinds of steroids, which are much, much lower dose and, to my knowledge, are not associated significantly with any of these problems.
Absolutely correct. That's an important distinction. Thanks for bringing that up. It's just as you said, it's the injectable or oral versions.
The inhaled steroids are thousands of times less medicine than the oral things, and they're not all the same, and they've done a dramatic had a dramatic impact on a lot of allergic disease. So I want to make sure we keep trying to clarify that. We're in our last three or four minutes here. Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I have two quick questions. One is, if they develop some glue they can stick into hips for people with osteoporosis or osteopenia, or is that on the horizon? And two, I had a friend who went outside a couple years ago to do what I was sort of described to me as a Roto-Rooter hip, where they didn't take off the ball of hip, and that really appeals to me rather than having body parts taken off. What is that really called, and in what conditions can it occur? And I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, thanks for your call.
The first question, no. There isn't anything that can increase bone mass, so that part's pretty easy. The second question, I'm having a hard time picturing what a Roto-Rooter operation in a hip would be. There is something analogous to that in a shoulder, but there is nothing like that done in a hip, at least not in the same manner as in a shoulder. But the closest thing that I could come up with would be a hip arthroscopy, where one goes in with an arthroscope and can debride some delaminating articular cartilage from the hip, or debride torn labral cartilage, but not in the same manner as it's done in the shoulder.
Okay, so there's some arthroscopic work that can be done to clean up various problems without having to replace the joint. It's kind of a preservation of the joint is what you think she's alluding to.
I think if she hasn't had anything cut off or replaced, that's about the only other operation that we do inside the joint.
Okay. All right, we're in the last minute or so. You want to mention briefly the fact that you do some elbow replacement, which, is not a common one, but you were telling me rheumatoid arthritis victims often seem to benefit from that.
Yes, elbow replacement is a hugely satisfying operation, and to my knowledge, I think I'm just maybe not quite the only one, but just about the only one who does do those here in Alaska. It's an operation where we replace the elbow joint, and people with rheumatoid arthritis in particular have such joint destruction that the elbows become non-functional. They get terribly deformed and stiff and painful. And it's hugely satisfying to be able to replace the joint, restore full or close to full range of motion and function to the elbow in terms of daily activities of daily living. These folks are quite incapacitated, as you can imagine you might be if you can't use your arm. And to be able to replace that, it's great. It's a very successful operation. It's one not meant to go out and start running a jackhammer or splitting wood or something like that. The elbow, like the ankle, is a small joint, and if you start pounding on it, it's not designed to take that sort of stress and can fail.
All right. John, thanks very much. It's just been a pleasure having you with us today on line one.
It's been fun. Thank you very much for having me.
If anybody wants to continue this kind of conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our new website, alaskapublic.org. Otherwise, why don't you join us next Monday, October 3rd at 2 p.m., when we have the next edition of Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest at that time will be vocal physician Dr. Sarah Roberts, and we're going to be discussing the anxiety, depression, and other mood disorders that seem to frequently accompany pregnancy and the postpartum period. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening, especially those who took the time to give us a call today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.